The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, for those of you who are new here, maybe the first time, we do have these hearing system devices on the counter in the outer hall because, you know, even with the speaker system, I have such a low voice. I keep my voice low, and if I'm going to say something very profound, I'll say it with a very soft voice. So, I apologize for that. So, welcome to IMC, and thank you for being here. And I don't take it for granted the opportunity to sit in community and meditate together. I certainly appreciate it and value that opportunity. And maybe I'm feeling that particularly because of the topic for today. I'm going to talk about what in Pali is called sila, S-I-L-A, and often translated into English as ethics or virtue. And it's the middle part of the Eightfold Path. So two Sundays ago I talked about the Four Noble Truths, and the fourth noble truth is a truth of the way to the cessation, to the ending of suffering. And that's specified as being a set of eight practices. And these eight practices sometimes said to encompass Buddhist practice. All forms of Buddhist practice somehow are held within these set of eight. And it's a big list, you know, eight things. But, you know, if you are in this for the long term, it's relatively easy to learn. And it's a really good list to have in mind because as you go through your life, different circumstances, different ones of these Eightfold Paths, aspects are relevant and come into play. And so it's a way of hopefully having the Dharma, the practice of Buddhism, be integrated into your life or have your life integrated into this practice. And so last week I talked about five of them. I talked about the first two, which is right view and right attitude. And I talked about the last three, right effort or right endeavor, I called it, right endeavoring, and right mindfulness and right concentration. And I think I said one sentence on right mindfulness. But and those two sets, the first two have to do with wisdom, the wisdom factors, and the last three have to do with a meditation practice or cultivating, developing the mind, what you do with your mind. And then in between those has to do with your action, what you do, how you live your life in the world. And that's sila, and as I said, often called ethics. Probably the in how it's utilized in the teachings of the Buddha, probably the best translation into English, which is currently being used by Bhikkhu Bodhi, the great translator of our texts, he translated it as virtuous behavior. Because the idea of ethics can suggest the idea of something abstract, principles that you're supposed to kind of learn or live by. And the idea of virtue suggests you're supposed to have these wonderful, sweet, inspiring qualities inside, which is nice if you had. But when you say virtuous behavior, you're specifying behavior. Behavior counts. Behavior is important, how you live your life and what you do. And so these middle factors of the Eightfold Path have to do specifically with behavior. So the first two have to do with understanding. The last three have to do with how you cultivate your mind. But then living your life is very important. And so that's what the topic is today, is virtuous behavior. And as a further introduction to this topic, I want to first point out that generally virtuous behavior, ethical behavior, has to do with our relationship with what's outside of us, most predominantly with other people, sometimes other living beings, sometimes the planet itself. But it's being in relationship to something. And it's easy if we've emphasized meditation too much to get the idea that that maybe this Buddhist practice is all about, you know, withdrawing from relationship it's not being in relationship. It's being somehow independent and free and disconnected. But actually, it's the opposite is true, that the Dharma practice is a practice that if you do it well, it leads to a growth in connectedness and a deeper sense of being connected to others and the value of that relationship between others and oneself, self and others, and caring for that, being caretakers for that and for ourselves and for the welfare of others. And the idea of ethics, or this sila, virtuous behavior, it's sometimes listed as the first of the three trainings. So this is a turning around of the Eightfold Path, which prioritize ethics as being the first, or virtuous behavior being first. And then there's a meditation, and then there's wisdom. And wisdom can then is given the pride of place as being at the top, the best, the highest. And so some reasonable people maybe would think, well, I'm not going to bother with this ethics stuff. I'm just going to go right to the wisdom. And that's what I want, because, you know, I want the real stuff, the important stuff. And, you know, since the first training is in ethics, that's kind of kindergarten Buddhism. And I don't really care about that, or I'm basically an ethical person, or that's for other people, and I just want really to get the real stuff, meditation and insight and enlightenment, and, you know, and so I'm just going to, you know, just go for my own enlightenment, and just, you know, these people are just in the way. And it's actually the opposite, the whole path of practice is so deeply integrated with our relationship to the world that there is no kind of pulling ourselves completely, independently, aloofly away from the world. That the wiser we become, the deeper we practice, the more we cultivate the mind, the more that's actually integrated, integral to how we behave in the world. And the two go hand in hand. There's no separation between the two. And if you have some doubts about this, there's this wonderful quote from the Buddha. I quote it a lot because it's one of my favorite quotes these days, where he defines a wise person. So for those of you who want to become wise and quickly and want to kind of just like, you know, put aside this lower stuff, this ethics, and I hope Gil doesn't talk about the precepts, because then we're back in nursery school. So the quote goes, a wise person, a person of great wisdom, is someone who considers the welfare of themselves, the welfare of others, the welfare of self and others, and the welfare of the whole world. And someone who's concerned with the welfare of all this, all living beings, including oneself, is living in relationship to other people, is concerned about what's going on there with others, is considering them, aware of them, attentive to them. And it's the idea of considering their welfare. It doesn't just mean that you're sitting in an ivory tower thinking about, you know, it'd be a good idea if someone helped them. But rather it's really having a living, heartfelt concern and connection and perhaps actions in the world to support other people. And so if the goal of Buddhism is to become a wise person, a person of great wisdom, in a sense, it begins with developing your ethical behavior, and it ends with ethical behavior, and it involves ethical behavior all along in between. That the idea of ethical behavior, how you behave in the world, is completely integral to the whole path of Buddhism. It's not elementary, it's not nursery school, it's actually the beginning, middle, and end is to be concerned and interested in this topic. So it doesn't take much reflection to consider how much we are social beings, how much we belong to others, they belong to us, we're so deeply connected. And I think, I don't know if it's a product or a result of modern society, sometimes even urban society has it more, where more packed in people are, the easier it is to feel alone or disconnected. And modern forces sometimes keep people from being connected in a deep way. And so, you know, I think our society could do a lot more in creating vehicles for people to feel more sense of belonging and connection. But, you know, we have it. It's very deep. It's, you know, in our DNA, in a sense. But I was reflecting on this for a number of reasons lately. And it's kind of seen symbolically that you know, when we are in gestation, there's a human being who we're really close to. Boy, do we belong. You know, we're being cared for and tended. Everything, all our needs comes from this, our mothers. And then when we come out of our mother, generally it's someone's hands who catches us, takes us, holds us. And, you know, we are met as we come into this world with hands, caring hands. I think it's a fantastically symbolic thing that we come into this world in someone's caring hands. And I remember the doctor took my son and pretty quickly kind of handed him to me. And I remember what it was like to hold him in my hands first time. This idea of, you know, and then, you know, we raised him and... And there was a lot of, you know, he depended on us. You know, those first days, you know, 120%, you know, depended completely on everything we do. And then there was a slow process of, you know, of him growing up. And then he started to wean his parents of him. And then, you know, and I don't know who was, you know, ahead of the other. And I'm thinking about this a little bit because last week he turned 22, and for me personally, that was a significant age. It was more significant than 21 or 18 or something. But I remember so well, you know, the hospital and the birth and what that was like, and holding him first time in my hands. And then I was on Friday. I spent some time with a man who had died, and I stood for a little while, you know, by him, and put my hands on his, kind of on his temples, and just held him, and we did a little closest thing to what Buddhism has, like a prayer. We did a song. Those of us who were there. Kind of sang chanted the verses of loving kindness for this person, the person's family, and everyone. And you know, I thought about this person, you know, that, you know, was also born and had parents and belonged to someone, cared for them, and probably had family members and had life experiences and had been a child and a teenager and a young adult and dealing with all these challenges and maybe some of the joys of life. And a big part of that has to do with the community you're in or the community you're not in. And some people, the idea of connection is very, very painful, not having it. It still represents how important it is. And symbolically, in the Buddhist tradition, this is, I think of it as represented by the idea that when they say that when the Buddha was born, in a kind of a cosmic scale, you know, that a mythic scale, that when the Buddha was born, his mother was standing, so he came out, and that he didn't touch the ground because the gods came with their hands to hold him up. And when he died, the gods came, and also were there attending to him, and then they when it was time after he to cremate the Buddha. The pyre wouldn't burn, is how the myth goes, and so no one knew what to do. They were trying to light it, and it wouldn't burn. But then one of his main disciples, who had been away at the time, finally made it to the cremation, and he unwrapped part of the shroud that was holding the Buddha from his feet, so his feet were exposed. And then he touched the feet. And then the fire lit. Spontaneously. because it's a myth, right? It's a symbolic of something very important. So this idea, you know, that you're born in the hands, something holds you, and then you die. You know, many people die with touch, and someone touching them perhaps, or with them, and I've been with people who died, and you know, I can't think of one of them if there wasn't someone touching them while they died. And and just imagine, you know, that nowadays we have all this, you know, we have wonderful artificial intelligence and robotics and a lot of things. We want to make them efficient and cheaper, and it'll be great because what we'll do is we'll have automated hospice. And we'll just have these systems of, you know, conveyor belts that we'll put our dying people on, and the sensors that will understand all their needs. And we have wonderful robotics. It's amazing what the robots can do with their hands that come down. And they will take care of every possible need. And you know, as they're going through their dying process, the conveyor belts, like at Amazon, you know, they go, you know, they fork out, and the people who have certain condition go left, and those other can go to the right, and the robots come and take care of them. And all their needs are taken care of. They'll be comfortable as can be, and it'll be great. And then they'll die. And the robots will come. The robots, you just... And then they do the next thing, and the conveyor belt goes the other direction, whatever. That would be horrible, right? The human touch, the human contact, the human presence—you know—it's such an important part of human life and belonging and being connected. And so, this idea that the Eightfold Path, that the central, the middle three have to do with our relationship and rectifying that, caring for it, being careful with it, practicing with it. It's part of the Buddhist practice. It's part of the way how we become wise, how we become liberated, is to care for our ethical behavior. Be attentive to it, reflect on it. And I would say that our modern society is ethically complex and confusing. Levels of interconnectedness spreads out from us is more complex in this kind of modern world than they probably have ever been in human history. And what we do here in California is directly related to what's going on in sometimes very obscure places around the globe in a way that it wouldn't have been the case hundreds of years ago or thousands of years ago. And even with our society, the complex ways in which we relate to each other and the government and caring for each other, not caring for herself, and immigrants who are coming here and how they're treated, and you know, how we treat people of different economic status, how we treat people of different races and ethnicity, and how we learn to live together. It's a complex world of how to do this in this modern world. And they say in Buddhism that... it's part of one's wonderful myths, symbolic, that each person chooses where they get born. They say that before you got born, you were kind of like a disembodied kind of thing getting ready to be born, and you looked around for your parents and said, "Oh, those are the two," and zoop, you zip right down and. And or at least a stork brought you or something, and so this. But this idea, this idea that Buddhism has actually is a choice involved in where we get born. So guess where you got born, or where you ended up. You know, you got born in such a way that you came here, and this is where you are. This is your society. This is the complex world you're in. And so, how do you participate in it? How do you engage in it? And so to think ethically, to be concerned with behavior and impact of our behavior in this world is not just seeing what's in front of you and the persons in front of you, but it's things that ripple out that are part of your unseen world, unseen because it's so complex. So to be to care for that, but to care for it, this is the interesting part of it, and I think really really alive and interesting for Buddhists, to care for our relationship, to care for the people around us, to be concerned for their welfare, to want to avoid causing harm, to not do it because it's a moral obligation, to not do it because, you know, we have this huge responsibility as a burden, thou shalt do this, but to do it because you're inspired, that it's really for your own welfare. It's really a way for you to discover how to be lighter, how to be clearer, how to be cleaner, how to be wiser, how to grow and develop. How to discover greater freedom. And if you're discovering greater freedom, personal freedom, freedom, psychological, spiritual freedom, as you do these practices around ethics, then it's not a burden. Then you see, oh, this is a good thing. Of course I don't want to close down. For me, I had no interest in ethics growing up. It wasn't a concept of my mind. I never thought about it particularly, and no interest in it at all. In fact, if someone asked me or I thought about it, I probably felt probably had a little bit of a distaste. I don't know if distaste is the right word, but I kind of maybe looked down on people who were too ethical. You know, it's like, you know, somehow they were, too puritanical or something. And it was very unformulated in my mind. It was that far away, this whole thing. And fortunately, my imagination was very small for what I could do. So I really didn't do anything unethical, but that was just a coincidence of maybe a poor imagination. But that it really came alive for me, the idea of this ethics and being interested in the precepts that Buddhism has. When I sat my first longest retreat, I'd sat up to that point in Thailand, and I sat for 10 weeks. And to my surprise, sitting and meditating for that long, I got still, I got concentrated, I became quite open, very sensitive. And a lot of my usual chatter and preoccupations and concerns kind of fell away for a period of time. And in that radical, beautiful simplicity of being, I felt in the language of my body, the only words I could put on it at the time, it was a visceral, embodied feeling, was a feeling of inner purity. And the sense of this inner purity or cleanliness was something that was so new to me. It was like coursing through me, like my bones, or my veins, or like a field or a vibration of purity. It's kind of clarity. It's kind of like I'd been dirty and I took a really nice shower and I felt so clean afterwards. But it was all on the inside. It was my heart and my torso and my inside in a way that I never had before experienced. And that was nice. I was kind of like blown away by this feeling. And then I noticed that if I had any motivations or thoughts that were kind of unwholesome, that I felt that that inner sense of purity got contracted, got darkened. It got kind of lost. It kind of felt like a little bit of a violence towards it. And so now the idea of being ethical was not an obligation or responsibility or duty or something heavy to do. It was actually the opposite. The heaviness came from picking up these unwholesome tendencies, being angry or lustful or something like that. That's where the burden was. Keeping that sense of inner purity, that's where the lightness was. That's where the joy was. That's where the freedom was. So rather than taking ethics as a burden or like, you know, now you're a bad person and you have to kind of do this, I would propose that for Buddhism, it's absolutely opposite of that, that we engage in this. Because we have some sense of the freedom that comes from how we're better. Life is better. I'm an old guy now, but so when I was a kid, we had this common commercial on TV that said, blondes have more fun. And Ajahn Amaro, this Buddhist monk, he wrote an article that said, the title was, Monks Have More Fun. So he probably knew that commercial too. And ethical people have more fun. I mean, that's the idea. That should be the principle. And so I know it's hard to always to see it that way. But that's the inspiration. So these three middle parts of the Eightfold Path are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And so it begins with right speech. And I think that's kind of fascinating to consider that. I don't really know why the Buddha chose that, to list that first. But I kind of interpret it to mean that speech maybe is more important than action. Maybe more harm gets done in the world through speech. Speech maybe is the foundation for many other things. People who end up doing harm in the world, sometimes the harm began because of how people were speaking to each other. That speech is a binder. You know, once these kids grow up and their diapers no longer need to be changed and you're no longer feeding them, at some point the vehicle for a relationship is speech. We talk to each other, and as important in communication. So right speech. How do we talk in such a way that we're caring for everyone, for self and other people? How do we talk in such a way that the speech, that acts that we do not sever connections, but enhances connections? It's so easy to speak in ways that cuts the connection. Even if people we love and care for, we can say no, or we can say something and then we change the subject, or we say, it's not like that. No, it's not like that. Let me tell you. There's all kinds of ways in which, in subtle ways, maybe no one even notices it, the actual movement of the conversation is separation, is not coming closer, but actually being pulled apart. And so how can we speak in such a way that we avoid the severing of connection, the distancing, and how can we talk in such a way that we enhance the connection and come closer? And just that question is enough. You can go home now. If you carry that with you as a regular, ongoing question and reflection, and you start using the mindfulness to see how this works, to see how the speech acts that you're involved in, the impact it has on the conversation and your relationship to the other people, do you come closer, do you go further away, and both with people you're close to, but also strangers. What happens when you... Sometimes it's more clear with strangers. I've sometimes... Strangers have come up to me or something, and I've said something in reply, and I walk away, and I realize, wait, there was absolutely no connection. where's the train station? Point. and I head off. Maybe I'm in a hurry. And, I did what they needed. I helped them out, and I knew where the train station is, I can pat myself on the shoulder. I did a good deed. However, there was no connection formed. To stop. Oh, you're looking for the train station. Yeah, I can tell you. It's just right down there. But that's all, that's how long it needs to take to make a connection. But then you're really there with them. You stop, and you've taken them in as a human being. They feel seen and recognized and known, as if, you're delighted to see them or appreciate them. It can be that simple, this thing about, making a connection as opposed to not making it. And but to really get down to what's really important, the right speech, the third part of the Eightfold Path, has a number of criteria that are reflected on. One is to speak in ways that are honest. Speak the truth. The other is to speak is not harsh, to avoid harsh speech, to speak in kind ways and gentle ways, to speak, don't, so harsh is one thing, the separate from that is cruel, don't speak in cruel ways, speak in compassionate ways and caring ways. There's also this idea of this is a little bit perplexing because we don't really know what the Pali word really means, the ancient language. It's usually translated as idle speech. And but some idle speech connects in a good way with people and makes connections, so it can't just be all idle speech. But maybe it's trivial conversation that makes no living, valuable human connection to someone else. Maybe that's what it means, just kind of feeling the time and just chatting about silly things in a way that actually just doesn't help. There is so there's you know, to be careful for our relation, our speech, and then it's a training. So it means you're not expected to do it well yet. And this, I think, is empowering and relieving. It's relieving because you don't have to hold yourself up to this high standard. You're already supposed to be there. It's a training, and so as a training, you have to be interested in doing the training. So where is the opportunity to train in right speech? Well, if you go downtown and someone asks you where the train station is, that's your opportunity. If you go to the supermarket and there's the checkout clerk and the clerk says something to you, that's your opportunity to practice there and see how does that work. And so, you know, actually any time you're speaking with someone, it's a training ground. Some people... I've heard some people, they say, you know, I really want to go on retreat. Or, you know, some people, you know, can go on retreats, but I can't go on retreat. I work, I have family, I can't do this. And I should go off and be a monastic for a while and go off to Asia and practice for a year and come back and I'll be happy ever after and all kinds of things. And but I can't. Well, then your monastery is how you speak to people. It's right there waiting for you. You don't have to go off on retreat. You don't have to go off to monasteries. If you take every speech act you have as your monastery, that's your retreat. You know, how you practice, how, what you do there. The opportunity is right there. You're speaking anyway, if you are. So take it on. Be sensitive, be aware. So here's a very interesting... So I gave you one question to reflect on when you do speech, and that is, does the speech acts connect you or sever the connection? Here's another interesting question to carry with you as you speak. Why are you going to say what you're about to say? So ideally, you do it beforehand. But it is useful to ask afterwards, why did I say that? That's also useful. But why am I going to say what I'm about to say? But don't settle for the first answer. Why am I about to say what I'm going to say? Oh, because they asked me directions to the train station. You know, I didn't get very deep there. That's obvious. That's just kind of like brushing off the question. Why am I telling them the answer? Because they asked. No. Oh, because I care about them. Or I want to show off that I know the way. There are some countries in the world I've traveled in, which after a while I learned that no one would ever tell you they didn't know the way. They always point. But it might be completely the wrong way. So I learned you had to ask a few people, because no one would ever say, you know, I don't know. So sometimes we speak in order to show off, you know, something, or show them how great, I'm the great, you know, direction giver. But, you know, it takes a little bit of work to get underneath our surface of our minds. Why are you really saying this? What's going on? What are you really trying to do here? And keep reflecting and looking. You'll learn a lot about yourself if you keep asking, why do you say what you say? What's underneath it? What are you trying to do? And also, don't settle for one thing, because we can have multiple intentions, multiple purposes in our speech. And if you settle for the first answer, you're missing a great opportunity to start seeing yourself deeper and deeper. So then the fourth step of the Eightfold Path is right action. And this is specified as being three forms of action. The action of not killing people, the action of not stealing from people, and the action of not engaging in sexual misconduct, not harming people through our sexuality. And these are all negative statements. It's what we refrain from. And for some people, refraining is not a popular thing to do, and it's not very inspiring. But if we just consider a little bit how much harm and how much social disruption happens through those three things, killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct, sexual abuse, sexual, you know, harm, it's monumental what happens in our society and probably the world. And we would live in a radically different place. And we would contribute to a radically different world if we were really careful in these three areas. Probably here in this room, but certainly in our society wide, there are people who did not have, were not kept safe from those things. And it became lifetime impacts on their, on who they are and shape themselves and how they see themselves, understand the world, and ways that, you know, sometimes it's a lifetime they're healing from what happened to them. And so to offer a world where this is where we care for this and where we people know we care for it and this is a value to make a world that's safe is a beautiful thing. And for, in terms of your own heart, you harm your own heart if you do those things. You close things down, you contract. And so this movement towards freedom, to being lighter and more open, is supported dramatically by really a lot of care with these, this area. And for most people here, it's not like you're going out to, you know, Sunday afternoon killing spree. But does your life indirectly impact the death of others, the death of animals, the death of species that this world has? Are you really living a harmless life, or does it ripple out from you into all these different areas that in this world where so much is dying these days? And then the final of the three ethical parts of Eightfold Path is called right livelihood. And, you know, I don't think they had livelihoods in the time of the Buddha like we have here, like, you know, like let's go to school and get a career, vocational school and get a career, and this is my career. And I think it really, and also a lot of this was related to people who were renunciants. Renunciants had this thing called ajiva, livelihood. I think it meant a way of life. So live a way of life. But a way of life back in ancient India was intimately, for lay people, people who were not renunciants, was intimately related to the work they did. That's how they survived. It wasn't like, you know, an optional thing. But it has to do more how you live your life, the way of life. And so it includes work, for sure. But it also includes people who are no longer working. It includes in retirement, for example, the way of life you have then. Or before you work, you don't have a livelihood. Kids don't have livelihoods, but they can have a right ajiva, like this right way of living. And so to live a life, your way of living in the world is you go through the world trying to avoid harm, to not harm others. Not harm others through the work you do, not harm others through how you consume, your consumptions you have, and not harm others through your recreational choices, not harm others in just how you go through the world. To walk through the world with a light touch, a light foot, you know, leave only footsteps, footprints, or leave the world a better place than you found it when someone received you in their hands. So this is the middle part of the Eightfold Path and central to the Buddha Dharma. And it's not elementary. Differently. When it's elementary for you, it's elementary. When it's middle-level practice, it's middle-length practice. And when you're an advanced practitioner, whatever that is, ethics is advanced practice. And there's ethics every step along the way, from the first contact with the practice and doing it all the way up to full awakening. It's an ethical path. It's a path to an ethical transformation. It's a path to living a virtuous, good, helpful life for this world that we live in. It's intimately integral part of the Buddha Dharma to do this. And if you want to become free of suffering, to have this liberation that the Four Noble Truths are about, the Eightfold Path is the way, And at the heart of the Eightfold Path is these three steps of virtuous behavior. Thank you.